Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Welcome to the Inside Lacrosse Division 3 Podcast. I'm Zach Babbo. Today we have a special Supersize Selection Sunday themed episode. We're going to explore the potential Division 3 playoff field. In fact, today's podcast is so big, we're going to break it into two parts. First, to break down the D3 tournament format, the pool bids, and the selection criteria were driven by D3 committee chair and Lynchburg coach Steve Kadelka. In part two, we'll do some playoff prognostication, as Inside Lacrosse D3 notebook writer Ken Stockman comes on to talk about the 19 AQ races. Finally, to break down the pool B and C bids, and generally to give his take on the playoff field, is a popular forum commentator who has an uncanny habit of picking this tournament pretty much to a T, a guy who goes simply by D3. As always, I want to thank everybody for listening to these weekly podcasts. You can find all of Inside Lacrosse's podcasts at the iTunes Store under Inside Lacrosse, or find them at www.insidelacrosse.com. You can find me on Twitter at Zach Babbo, that's at ZACHBABO, no spaces, or email me ZBABO@insidelacrosse.com. Make sure to follow Inside Lacrosse all weekend to see how all three men's lacrosse fields are shaping up, and file ILWomen.com to see how the women's field is shaping up. The D2 field will be announced at 7:30, and the D3 field will be announced at 10, both on NCAA.com. And the D1 announcement show will be at 9 on ESPNU. Follow IL all Sunday night for breaking coverage of the tournament fields and analysis of the playoff matchups, as well as thoughts on who got in and who was left out. Okay, now let's get to our interview with Division 3 committee chair Steve Kadelka. Okay, the D3 podcast is joined by our first repeat guest, Coach Steve Kadelka of Lynchburg. Today we have Coach K on to talk as more of an NCAA official, perhaps, than the Lynchburg coach, as he's been a member of the NCAA selection committee for several seasons. Now, I guess, Coach, can maybe you start by telling me what's your involvement with the committee, a particular title or I guess, a responsibility within that kind of specific task?
Sure. This year, this is my fourth year on the committee, and I have been one of the there's two Southern Region committee members. This year it's myself and Stuart Moen at Susquehanna, and then there's two Northern representatives, and this year Sean Cork from Endicott and Rob Randall from Nazareth. And that committee is a several-year standing committee. And this year, Fran Shields, over the last several years, was our chairperson to that committee, and he rotated off this past summer. And then I was duly noted as the chairperson for this year, and this will be the last year on the committee. And looking forward to it. You know, it's a daunting task, but at the same time, it's a way to get back to the game.
Coach, what are the responsibilities for just being the Southern chair
on
the committee?
Yeah, well, we have, we started a couple weeks ago, and once a week on Tuesdays we hold both there's a Northern call and a Southern call. We call them RAC calls, Regional Advisory Committee. And we have a call on those Tuesdays, and we have probably 10 or 12 members, on the committee. And basically go through, we follow a format and a script that the NCAA provides us through a computer system, and our task during that call is to, really spend about an hour talking about the teams that could potentially be ranked. This year we are ranking 16 teams in the South, and the North is ranking 14 teams. So Rob Randall and Sean conduct that call up North. Stu Moen and myself conduct the call down the South. And then by the end of that working day, the members of the committee, the RAC members of the committee, go online and submit their votes. And those votes are sent to the NCAA office. They are tallied there. Will Hopkins is our liaison to the Men's Lacrosse Championship. And that sometime that evening, on Tuesday evening, Will sends us the information, sends out to the committee members, the four of us. And then next on Wednesday morning, at 11 o'clock, we get on the phone call for about another hour and just go through the Northern, what the Northern side looks like, what the Southern side looks like, and if everything meets up with kind of what we were talking about the day before. Any questions? We also start to look into the Pool B teams, if there's any Pool B considerations. So kind of just basically the main purpose of this committee in our estimate, Zach, is to have several weeks, and I think it ends up being 4 weeks of calls. So when we get to selection Sunday on May 5th, and even the day before on May 4th, we have a pretty good feel for and really have a consistent theme in place there for the time being to look at all this data, look at all the teams. As we get to that selection Sunday, we're not starting brand new, and trying to do all that on one day would be crazy. And so we really have the help of the RAC members. And then we have the championships committee. And so therefore on that Sunday, by the end of the working day on that Sunday, we have, a championship field, which we'll have this year. We'll have 19 AQs, automatic qualifiers, 5 teams coming from the Pool B selection cast, and then 5 Pool C members. So a tournament field this year of 29 teams, which would be the largest it has ever been. And, our task is to put together the most, the best championship that we possibly can.
Well, I definitely want to get into kind of the structure element, because I should admit this as the guy who runs the D3 podcast, but a little bit of the D3 kind of playoff format escapes me in terms of the pools and that kind of a setup. Mm-hmm. But you said 29 teams is the largest the field's been. I guess what has prompted the increase, or is that kind of a thing you guys adjust year to year? Was that a set thing of every couple of years as more programs get into the D3, world generally, that the you guys correspondingly increase the tournament to go with it?
Well, every Division III, and I think I'm saying this correctly, but every Division III championship field is based on percentages. It's based on a percentage that the NCAA is as designated in relation to the teams that are eligible for the championship. So men's lacrosse numbers, as you can imagine, over the years have grown exponentially. And as the growth of the teams able to compete at the Division III level for lacrosse has grown, so have the allocation of teams into that championship field. And so the AQs, the automatic qualifiers, are designated by conferences that are eligible to send their automatic qualifier to the tournament. And so there's parameters that the NCAA championships committee for every sport puts on. But our numbers, our ratios allow us this year to have a 29-team field. And I think next year we're even going to be a little bit larger than that. And so this year we have 19 automatic qualifying conferences the winner of that conference will lock up a Pool A bid to the NCAA tournament. And then if you are not in a Pool A, if you are not in a conference that has an automatic qualifier, then you are automatically designated to the Pool B field, which really we probably throw out the term independence. There still may be teams that are affiliated to a conference that are still Pool B teams based on the fact that their conference, for whatever reason, maybe it's size of the conference and number of teams in the conference, they do not garner one of the 19 automatic qualifying bids. They do not qualify to be an automatic qualifier. And that can change from year to year based on, maybe where they stand and when they were formed, et cetera, et cetera. And those are just kind of the nuances of the NCAA. And then after that, whatever teams are remaining in Pool B, whatever teams did not win the automatic qualifier, then they get thrown into the Pool C structure. And from there, there will be allocated 5 Pool C bids. And so, that's how you get to 29. So it's really the initial thought of it is to get to 29 is a mathematical formula that's done for every sport. And then from there, you kind of look at, okay, how many AQs do you have? And then, once again, you crunch the numbers again, and it gives you another ratio, that gives you the Pool B, and then whatever the remainder number is, which this year was 24, then that means you have 5. Last year we had, I think, 7 Pool C bids and 3 Pool B. This year, just the way the mathematics were done, it ended up being 5 Pool Bs and 5 Pool Cs.
Seems kind of, I guess, a neat math there. So with the pools then, is that strictly kind of about, you know, a path to the tournament, and then once you're into, you know, once you've made it by virtue of whatever pool you kind of land in, and you're part of that 2019 field, the pools no longer kind of matter in terms of the structure from there on out, or do the pools continue to influence the tournament field in terms of, you know, pool A bids play each other, pool B bids play each other and play in from there?
Right. So to answer your first question there, once the first thing that we have to do as a national committee is get 29 teams. And once we get that, once we get the 29 teams, then it becomes creating the brackets and working through that. So there is no, you know, pool A has to play a pool C team or pool B or whatever the case might be. It's really the pool A's, B's, and C's are just basically designated there as a structure to come up with the 29 teams. Once the 29 teams are selected, then we get into a whole nother procedure to make the bracket up. But there is no, there is no direct correlation between who's in the pool A compared to who you're going to play when you get to the end of the tournament.
And then, you know, the AQs are kind of, I guess, already predestined geographically. Mm-hmm. Do you guys have to kind of consider pool B and C with a certain geographic touch? I mean, is ideally that amongst those 10 pool B and C teams, you're hoping to do 5 north, 5 south, or is it strictly
no,
on just...
No,
yeah.
It's the best teams. You know, it's the teams that make up the, the top five teams that make up the pool B category, and our job is to allow them to advance to the NCAA tournament, and then the same thing, the remainder of whatever's left, the next five teams, you know, that are the best qualifying teams to make the NCAA tournament, those are going to be our teams. Now, how they shake out, we really don't think of that until, you know, you have, okay, you got to think of this one on that selection Sunday. Once we get those 29 teams, then it becomes, okay, now here's our bracket. Then the next level of creating the tournament takes shape. So first off, let's just get the best, or let's get the 29 teams that are there through the procedures that we have to follow. Then, okay, close the book on that. You know, that chapter's over. Chapter two begins, and now that is actually creating the bracket, which is interesting. I'll jump right into that if you don't mind. I mean, it is. It's basically, you know, in a perfect world, like we think of a bracket as the NCAA basketball bracket, you know, 1-16, 2-15. At our level, you know, at the Division III level, there's a lot of other factors that we want to take into consideration. Some simple ones like, ideally you try not to have two teams in the same conference play against each other in the first round. You're ideally trying to place teams that are pretty geographically close to each other. There is a limit of 500 miles. Anything over 500 miles is a flight. We're put to task to try to keep that to a minimum. I think last year we had one flight because Birmingham Southern was in the tournament last year and they had to fly up to Baltimore to play. And you know, but if you have a team in Birmingham, you're anywhere they would play. There's no team that made the NCAA tournament within 500 miles. So you're trying to limit the travel. You know, we don't necessarily go in there and rank. Once we get to 29 teams, we do not go in and then rank 1 to 29 and then just start putting things together. You try to stay as close as you can to create the best tournament possible, which means it makes sense. You're not going to have, if number one, or what hypothetically you think is being the best team in the North and the second best team in the North, if they are within, you know, they're really close to each other, we're not going to be that naive to sit there and say, well, we'll let them play against each other in the first round, getting so close. No, we're not trying to do that at all. But there are some things that make it difficult where we might kind of draw up a mock bracket initially once we get those 29 teams and then start to look at, okay, you know, what are some of the geographical issues, if we have any? Have teams put in, every team that wants to host a round of the NCAA tournament, they're asked to put in bids to the NCAA office. Have teams done their due diligence and done their paperwork? And so those are all the things that, those are some of the things that go into selecting the tournaments. And you also try to project down the road. If you had a perfect semifinal round, you would want the top two teams in the North going against each other, and you would want, hypothetically, the top two teams in the South going against each other for the chance to go to the national championship game. And so you try to work all those scenarios out, and it's definitely easier said than done, because sometimes you get that first bracket and you're like, God, this looks good, and then you start to really look at the distance and travel, and then you have to start to make some changes there, and that becomes a little bit of a task.
In terms of kind of that regionality split, is it at times maybe more difficult or easier to maybe play with some of the teams that almost have a more ambiguous geography, you know, teams in Ohio and Colorado, maybe in portions of the southern PA area, where, you know, they could kind of fall on either the north or south line, so you guys can maybe push them to either bracket to try and have a truer seeding or deal with geographic concerns, things like that?
Yeah, you know, I think like Denison's a great example of that. You know, last year they came down, sat in the southern bracket. The year before, they were in the northern bracket. You know, I know there's been years where, you know, a team like Goucher, one year, you know, even though they're in Baltimore, Maryland, I think that's kind of the south, they were in the northern bracket just based on, you know, where we kind of needed them to be as far as where they were kind of, you know, where they kind of were placed, and geographic, you know, constraints allowed them, since they're in the mid-Atlantic, to kind of move a little bit north or south depending on where they were. So yes, it is nice when you have a little bit freedom in those, you know, those schools and programs that kind of go right along that mid-Atlantic region, you know, the New Jersey, Pennsylvania, even up to Ohio. We do have more flexibility those. If you're Middlebury, you know, your Middlebury is not coming down to, you know, all the way down south to play a team like Roanoke. You know, that's just not, that's not what we're trying to do at all.
Does the NCAA have any kind of set parameters in terms of anything determining regionality? When I talk to some people, when they were trying to talk about things like, you know, in or out of region wins, it sounded like the NCAA kind of has borderlines and, or at least rough guidelines of, you know, this state is this.
In the selection component, you know, in what we're talking about in the regional advisory committee, you know, there's the primary criteria really right now, as of this year, 2013, really speaks to the in-region, your in-region performances. So if you are a team that is a southern team is playing a northern team and it's an out-of-region game, when we really start to look at the your numbers and your data that the NCAA gives us, that game, that out-of-region game, does not play a factor. Can it play a factor? Yes, it falls under the secondary criteria, but we've been asked and we're charged to look through the primary criteria first, which really deals with in-region results. Okay, and the reason that, you know, I think that came about several years ago, basically to tell schools, hey, listen, you're going to get rewarded, or you're, you know, the championship is going to be selected primarily on your in-region results. So, you know, it kind of cuts down on travel. It helps you. Our sport's a little unique in the fact that we only have two regions. For sake of purposes, everybody in the South region or everybody in the Northern region should be able to get a very good schedule, a very competitive schedule, just by staying in their own, you know, in their own region. And that's something that I think men's lacrosse, the sport of lacrosse, is really, really benefits from, the fact that our region, we have two regions, and at some point we might grow out of those. But right now, having two regions is very helpful, because you definitely have enough quality teams to play in either one of those regions.
Do you think the two-region thing, in some ways, I don't know how to phrase this maybe, but it almost adds something to the tournament in a way? I mean, the D1 tournament is obviously, you know, a different animal in general, but the kind of just general 16-team field, there's not necessarily a regionality to it whatsoever, just teams play into a championship, whereas every year the D3 field is, you know, the championship becomes north versus south. It maybe adds a bit of the geographic rivalry, what have you, that at times, you know, finds its way into college sports. Do you think that just has a particular color to the D3 championship in the long run?
You know, I think it does. I think because of, you know, over the years, you know, you've you've been so hit on to play in-region games, the crossover games don't happen as much because, you know, coaches might play one, you know, or two per year, but you just don't have them as much as you used to. You know, back, you know, 10 to 15 years ago, you kind of played everybody you could, you know, that was really good. And it's changed a little bit over the years because, you know, just the way the rules have been put into place. But I think it does add a little bit. I think it's, you know, you go to the championship and, you know, for example, a couple of years ago, you had Tufts, which was kind of coming onto the scene, and you had a perennial, you know, perennial team such as Salisbury. And, you know, no one gave Tufts a shot to win the national championship that first time they were there. And next thing you know, they're up by several goals, and Tufts wins that one, you know. And I think, you know, even, you know, in the past, you've had Middlebury and Salisbury playing against each other, or, you know, Middlebury and Gettysburg, you know. And so you kind of have that, you know, South versus North, the North versus South mentality to a degree. I think you're, you know, I think that's, and I think that, that does add, because you're almost, I don't say guaranteed, but there's a great chance you're going to get a championship game, like Cortland against Salisbury last year, where they're not going to play in the regular season. You know, the national championship game in Division I, there's a really good chance that, you know, you're going to have two teams playing that have already played maybe once, maybe even twice during that year if they're in the same conference, you know. So you don't necessarily that would be an interesting fact. I don't have that on me, but last year Cortland played Salisbury, they did not play regular season. You know, and the year before it was Tufts and Salisbury, they did not play regular. So you kind of can go through the years and say, how many times have those teams actually played regular season? I bet it's not a lot.
So obviously the AQs kind of take care of themselves, but then yep. The real kind of a maybe interesting minutiae everybody likes to get into is you know, the selection criteria for at-large bids and how you guys land on that. So you said already that, you know, the in-region wins are weighted heavier than other factors. Can you kind of take me through the hierarchy of what you guys consider, you know, in region wins, strength of schedule in the region, head-to-head,
sure.
And maybe even from there how much it breaks down in terms of, you know, comparing a team to regional teams compared to maybe, you know, taking the team's resume yep. and comparing it to everybody who's potentially eligible.
Well, that's really the main reason why we do these RAC calls, you know, every week, is to stay on top of what's happening. And we have, you know, the primary criteria that we do have, there's really five primary components, all right? There's obviously a win-loss percentage against regional opponents. There's a strength of schedule that is factored in. You know, that is done, you know, via the computer model. There are, you know, in-region head-to-head competition. There's in-region results versus common, you know, regional opponents. And then there's in-region results versus regionally ranked teams. So those are the five categories that we look at every week. And so as we're here towards the end of April, we really can populate all five of those categories for each team in the North, you know, and for each team in the South. And then at the end of the day, it's our charge to look at those 5 points of criteria and rank teams 1 to 16 in the South and 1 to 14 in the North regarding how, you know, which teams are the best. So obviously, you know, it's a school like Dickinson this year, who's undefeated, naturally, you know, in the schedule that they play, and they play against a bunch of teams that are ranked in the region already, you know, Southern ranked teams, they are going to be the number one team in the South. And it makes, you know, whether you think they are or not, mathematically, and the data that we look at, it's a simple, you know, that's simple that they're the number one team because they're undefeated, so they have a great win-loss percentage. They have a great strength of schedule, you know, and all this data shows up for us, so we can actually go onto a computer screen and Zach can pull all this up and have this at our fingertips while we're on that call. And that's really what we're, you know, those are the primary criteria. That is the first criteria that we were asked to look at. You know, the secondary criteria is basically we go to that if we can't really make a very dedicated decision using the primary criteria. And that's when out of region, you know, play might come into factor, you know, your overall Division III win-loss percentage, because there are some teams that might be 11-2 in region right? But maybe 13-2 total record, which means that they played two teams in the out of region that, that don't count towards your primary criteria. But they have a, you know, you add two more games to that schedule, and now that changes their numbers a little bit. And there's some other secondary criteria that we'll have to look at as well. So it's interesting. You know, I think there's it's nice that the NCAA gives us kind of the template, the computer template to look at. But at the end of the day, you know, you have, you know, you might have, you know, the Southern RAC members, just, you know, 12 members or so. That's, there's a human element there, you know, and there's, and that's understandable. The same thing in the Northern side. You know, but we use this data, we use these numbers to come up with those rankings to the best of our ability.
So I know the D1 field, you know, seeds the first eight, and then they leave the other eight more or less unseeded to kind of, you know, kind of what you were talking about before, if you want to try and stay true to seeding as much as possible, but it gives you a little bit of playability in terms of travel accommodations and the like. I'm a little confused or unsure, I guess. Does the D3 field really seed, or do you guys kind of do a more loose seed where you'd establish what the I guess, you know, better teams are, but don't necessarily put a number on them, and just use your knowledge of who you think is ranked kind of where to structure out the bracket?
I think that the, you know, the normal, you know, nomenclature or vernacular that people will use is seeding, you know, because people understand that. People look at brackets all the time, you know, and it makes sense. 5 plays 12, you know, we obviously need to create a level of hierarchy in the tournament structure, so we know from round to round, as teams win, correct, who's going to be considered the home team. So we do that. We do generally do that, but we do not, like I said earlier, we don't seed them in terms of, hey, number's one, this is number one, all the way down to, you know, this year would be 29, and then just start to mix and match. But we're going to have, on May 5th, we will have kind of a Southern and a Northern RAC vote that's going to give us, okay, this is the number one team right now in the South, number two, number three, number four. And from that, is that gives us the guidance to kind of look at the template that we want to follow for the NCAA tournament.
So I guess in a field of 29 this year, last year there were, you know, eight teams that I guess you could say got a first round bye, and
yeah.
And how does that break down, I guess, in the field of 29 in terms of, you know, who will get kind of that first round bye, who, how do you determine, I guess, I don't know if you consider the round before that a play in round or just generally the first round. I mean, 29 obviously doesn't break down into, you know, there's kind of one odd man out. Is there kind of a play in game to a first round, or how will almost that structure maybe set itself up?
Yeah, there's going to be I want to say, I think there's going to be two games or three games. I can't remember looking at the bracket, but you know, or two or three teams that will not have the ability to play in the first round. You know, and I don't exactly remember what that number is off the top of my head. That's something, if we get closer to that, we'll, you know, obviously we'll have the bracket in front of us, so we have to fill it out. But I think that's what, I want to say that's what it was. You know, I could probably pull that up as we're talking here. But there will be, you know, and this is what kind of makes, you know, the Division III tournament, I think, really, you know, kind of interesting, you know, and the fact that on we'll select the teams on Sunday, on May 5th. And, you know, that evening will be, you know, the teams will be announced and all that good stuff. And then basically once what ends up happening is, you know, you're going to have, you know, a lot of teams playing on Wednesday, you know, May 8th. And that makes for a pretty interesting, it's a pretty quick turnaround, you know, in terms of teams finding out their fate Sunday evening, right? And then, you know, I think the selection shows at 10 o'clock on Sunday evening. And now let's say you're playing away on Wednesday. That's a quick turnaround. And I think being an administrator at college and also understanding, you know, and being a team that has been selected for the tournament, you know, that those are, that's an interesting time frame, you know, because you not only have to do all the travel component to where you're playing, but you're also trying to find out all the information you can about your opponent. And so I think that's a really unique thing to our tournament that, you know, Division I finds out on Sunday, then they have a week, you know, to get ready for the next game. And I think the model that we have right now in Division III allows us the ability to quickly, you know, move from the teams are used to playing, you know, Wednesday, Saturday. That's more of a Division III model than it is a Division I model. But it's an interesting tournament. You know, it makes that tournament, you know, you have to have a lot of other factors go pretty well for you, you know, to be successful in the Division III tournament.
I was going to say, you know, obviously you don't want to constantly compare to D1, but that is one thing that kind of strikes me at the D3 tournament is you have a bigger field, so there's more games that need to be played in the first place. But the D3 tournament, or a lot of the complaints I've heard in the D1 tournament is that, you know, you get a week between games, first round, quarterfinal to Final Four, and then all of a sudden the championship, while it's a very sellable package of, you know, the two games in 3 days kind of deal, you know, that's a very rough turnaround does that produce the fairest champion or not? Whereas D3, your earlier rounds seem more clustered together, and then there almost seems to be a little more space later in the tournament. What do you think that does maybe in terms of influencing the eventual champion that comes out?
Well, I think this. I think that the model that Division I has been used for a really long time now, you know, and I think it's very successful. You know, I think it produces a great product on the field. I think it produces a great product for those people who are there. I think if you were to separate those semifinals and championship for a week, I don't know if it would have the same. So I love the Final Four, you know, championship weekend model that we have in lacrosse. I think, you know, you have two great games on Saturday, Division I games. Those are marquee games. Those are games that, you know, you walk around the parking lot, you walk around the stadium, there's so many little kids there. It's a family environment. It's the best of the best, you know, and I think that's what the NCAA wants, and I think that's what our sport wants. Sunday, you know, then you get the best of Division II playing against each other, and you get the best of Division III playing against each other on Sunday. Those are two great games. You know, then Monday, you roll in, and here's the national championship. You know, this is the culminating event of our sport for Division I, and you just had the culminating event for Division II and Division III less than 24 hours earlier. So, to me, that is the model that I think a lot of other sports, and I don't want to speak for other sports, but they're kind of, and Justice is probably not the right word either, but they would love to emulate what we do in our sport. We're in a wonderful venue. It's an awesome weekend. It is the culminating event of our sport for the year. And I think it speaks volumes. I would agree that, you know, and you also have to think about this. I mean, the Wednesday, Saturday, the Wednesday, Sunday format that we put together in the Division III model is there's a lot of other things going on there for those student athletes. Forget about the lacrosse part of it, but you might have graduation, you might have final exams, you might have, you know, you know, there's a lot of other stuff going on there that really makes that, you know, it's really 2 weeks. It's from Selection Sunday till the semifinal round, which is on the 19th. So it's 14 days there that are pretty crazy. You know, then if you advance that far, now you have a week to kind of catch your breath a little bit and get yourself ready for that Sunday championship. And, you know, so I think that's what's unique about it. You know, it is not you know, and I think it's a great venue, that it's a great model that we do have. I think the coaches understand it going in. I think the new teams that get in really embrace it in terms of saying, hey, this is really neat. You know, we're playing on Wednesday, and if we advance, we're playing, you know, just kind of keep on going through the bracket there. But it is challenging. There's no doubt about it. But I would like to point out that I feel like that championship weekend that we have this year in Philadelphia is a great culminating event for men's lacrosse in the NCAA level.
So another kind of key difference, it seems, between the two tournaments is the first round in the D1 tournament is all campus sites, and then every round after that is effectively a neutral site game. D3, how does that work in terms of, you know, are they all campus sites? Is it some campus sites, some neutral? I mean, obviously the championship game is going to be in Philly, you know, and that's a neutral site. But I was under the impression anyway that it's all campus sites leading up to it.
It is, you know, and it's been that, I think 1992 that was the first year that Division III entered that Division I model, you know, Franklin Field back in the day. And before then, even the national championship game, you know, back when Hobart had its run of national championships, when they were the highest seeded team, they played their national championship game on the campus of Hobart. It's just a pretty cool thing to think about, you know. But the way it is now is that every round, first round, second round, quarterfinals, and semifinals are all played on campus of the higher, you know, seeded, the higher ranked, higher placed team in that bracket. And, you know, I think that's a pretty neat thing, you know, and to have those games for some of those host institutions. That's a special weekend. It's a special day for those schools to be able to give their student athletes and their fans and the families the ability to have a home contest. I think there's something to be said for that. You know, I still remember talking to Fran Shields a couple of years ago, and as the athletic director at Connecticut College, and they were hosting a round, and you know, just the excitement that was placed on that campus. It was the first time they'd ever hosted that round, and it was unique. There's some challenges that are there, you know, from a college administration standpoint that are definitely unique to Division III that you probably don't have on the Division I level, But it just adds to the flavor of the championship, having all these rounds on campus, with the exception of the championship game.
Does that create any kind of a difficulty, though, maybe, in terms of structuring out the bracket? Because, you know, you need to take in travel considerations for so much, and so D1 just has to kind of worry about it for one round, and after that, teams just kind of filter into these neutral sites. Whereas, you know, I mean, you guys can't necessarily extrapolate out that far of, well, if this team wins, then this. But I guess you have to be kind of conscious that all of a sudden, if a team wins a round or two, they're not then 700 miles from the next team they're supposed to play or something.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, in a perfect world, you can look all the way down the line and make sure that nothing's going to happen. But at the same time, you have to, you know, the bracket's going to play itself out. You know, and as you move on, there's going to be teams that are favored, they're going to win, and there's going to be teams that are favored, they're going to lose, and that's going to change probably the geography in some instances of games that you were expected were going to happen, but also that's something that's the beauty of the tournament. You know, those things are going to happen, and you can't, you know, while we like to maybe think, okay, this is kind of the first round, and this is kind of the predictors, you know, they never play out this form, you know. And that's the beauty of it. And so it does make it, you know, those are the challenges. And I think that's, you know, that's what happens at our level. You know, Division I knows that one of those rounds is going to be in Indianapolis. You know, the other round will be in Bird Stadium. I believe that's the other site, you know. And they know that already. So they've already booked hotels. They've got, you know, as those host sites, they've done all that legwork. So those teams advance from the previous round. They just kind of pencil them in and say, hey, you're staying at this hotel. And we don't have that luxury at our level. And so it does make it unique, and it does make it a challenge. But for the most part, I think the coaches at our level are great, and the administrators at our level are great at making all that stuff work itself out.
I guess just to double back to some of the seeding stuff for a second, the one thing I want to ask is, you know, a lot is made on our website. We do a lot of bracketology posts, and a lot of them are based on the RPI stats that the NCAA produces. And, you know, for a 60 or so team, you know, D1 field, that might be an easier number to produce. Does the NCAA produce some kind of an official RPI statistic for the entire D3 field that you guys factor in?
We do not have an RPI. So, you know, yeah, you're right. You see these posts, you know, on the internet regarding Division I and you know, RPI and all that and how it's going to shake out. We do not have that for Division III. We do not have an RPI. So we're basically, the information that we have at our disposal is the information of that primary criteria that I relayed out earlier. You know, those are the numbers. That's the data that we have the ability to look at. We do not have an RPI. We don't have that ability to take a look into that. So it kind of makes it, you know, that's just the way it is. We just don't have it. So we don't really think about it when you don't have it.
You've been on the committee for a couple of years here. As D3 grows and the fact that the field is a percentage-based field, that obviously means that the field is growing or tends to grow from year to year. In your time in the committee, have you noticed, has the expansion of the tournament bracket made it maybe easier or more difficult to try and figure out? I mean, sometimes you would think it'd be easier because you can put more teams in, but sometimes the more teams you have to kind of parse through, the harder it is to kind of figure out who exactly are the people that belong within that field.
I remember when I was in college, there was eight teams, and the ninth team was bummed out that they didn't make it, and then we went to 12 and it was the 13th, or maybe the 14th team. Then we had these pool A's. I still remember the first year we had a pool A, pool B, pool C, which was the spring of 2001. And when the NCAA first put that legislation through, based on the percentages and based on the data that was there at the time, men's lacrosse did not have any pool C bids that first year. And so that was the year where Washington only was ranked, I think, number one or number two in the country and was having an outstanding year and ended up losing one of their last regular season games to at least their last Old Dominion Athletic Conference game to Hampton Sydney. And, they ended up tied in the conference, but Hampton Sydney won the head-to-head, and therefore they garnered the automatic qualifier for the ODAC. And next thing you know, when people really started to think and learn more about this AQ thing, it was like, so WNL is out, and WNL is left home that year. And, arguably, potentially maybe the best team in the country. And so that was, that was how it started. And so every year, based on the percentages, based on the numbers, the pool has grown. And now, I also think what's happened, obviously, the parity at our level has grown. I think there's two teams, at our level in Division III that are undefeated, Dickinson and Cortland, and that's it. And then there's I think one team with one loss. That's RIT right as of right now, and then everybody else has two or more losses. And you would think that a lot of these teams are very good. But they still have two, three, four, losses on their resume. And so I think what you're seeing is there's just a lot more parity out there. And so when you have parity, there's going to be teams that are not going to make the tournament. They're going to be, they're going to think that they could have beaten half the teams in the tournament. And then there's going to be teams that are in the tournament that people are going to say they don't belong to be in there. So that's the nature of the beast. We do know that the 19 automatic qualifying schools or automatic qualifying conferences, whoever wins that conference gets in, whether they are the first ranked team or the last ranked team, they go into their conference tournament if they have one, or however they select their AQ, they have the ability to make it to the NCAA tournament. They control their own fate as such. After that, pool B's are selected, and then you get into the pool C's, and it's kind of the best of the rest, and there's a lot of teams that will probably be considered to be the best of the rest, and that shows the parity that we have. So it's going to be difficult, and there's going to be teams going to be left out that will probably be unhappy. As a coach of a team that's been on that side of the bubble, it is not easy, talking to your team and explaining that to your team, but that's unfortunately, that's going to happen to some teams, and, that's just the nature of the beast.
You mentioned the overall parity of this year. You've been doing this for 4 years. Does this year do you have a sense of, does it feel like this year will be a comparatively, more or less difficult year to try and sift out that field with the seeming parity that's been going on this spring?
Yeah, I think there's going to be some teams that will not make the field that will, you could easily place in there, and if you just say, hey, show up on this field, we're going to play lacrosse, there's some teams that aren't going to make that tournament that probably could do pretty well in that tournament, But unfortunately, we have numbers, we have statistics, we have data that we have to use to select the field. And so when you do that, that's kind of what you're going by, and that's just the way it is, you know. But I do think what's neat about it is, you know, we kind of say on the committee all the time, you kind of win your way, you know, you win your way into this tournament. And what's nice about it is, I think this year more than any other year, is that you're kind of heading into the tournament. You know, there's a lot of teams that have proven that could beat each other. And so you kind of look at the tournament and say, well, I wonder if it's really going to shake out the way, you know, it should statistically or you know, by what you think. Because I think, you know, this, you know, the more you do this, the more there's games to kind of throw, you know, that they're going to be interesting to see how they work themselves out.
Is it difficult at all, or have you seen it being difficult maybe amongst coaches to be able to keep, you know, I mean, the idea, it sounds like, you know, you have to be able to keep an amount of impartiality coming into this because you're just ranking general teams. But, you know, you know your own team, you know some of the teams that, you know, you've played against and some of the ones that you haven't. So, you know, there's a natural inclination. I mean, I'm in journalism and everybody says, you know, the idea is to be objective, but every person kind of brings their own experience into everything they do in life. I mean, what do you, you know, how do you kind of weigh that, or is it maybe naturally balanced because when you have a couple coaches in the room, the mix of everyone's experience of that season kind of balances each other out, and there's hopefully not too much, you know, schism amongst everybody in terms of favoring teams they've played or their own team?
Well, what I would say is, you know, number one, when we do the regional advisory committee, you know, this every conference has representatives on this committee. So it's not like there's, you know, seven coaches from one conference. I mean, it is, there's great equal representation across the board from the pool A's to the pool to the independents. And so that allows the ability, I think, for us to get into on a conference call each week and be pretty impartial for the most part. You know, and we're all human, you know, and that's going to happen. I think when we get to the selection day, as an example, you know, myself being the chairperson this year, you know, I will probably be off that call for a majority of it if Lynchburg is involved in the discussion, I cannot be a part of any of that discussion. If Nazareth is involved in the discussion, Rob Gofrandel cannot be a part of it. So we have people that we will ask from members of the RAC to be on this, to be on these conference calls. So when, you know, if you know, we're fortunate to be talking about, you know, one of our schools or Susquehanna or even Endicott for that matter, we have to remove ourselves from the call and we have no say. We don't, we have nothing to do with that part of the conversation until it is either determined that, you know, one of our schools is either in or out, and then we can move back into the conversation. But it's, and I think that's, you know, Fran Shields has done a great job of that over the years. I know, you know, a couple of years ago we were not selected for the tournament, but we were one of the teams considered for Pool C. It's basically like, hey, you're on the call, but, you know, we're going to start talking about Pool C now, and you need to get off, and we'll call you when we're done, you know, and you know, an hour and a half later they give you a ring, and you're like, okay, you know, like, sorry, you're not in, you know, like, okay, well, let's do what we got to do here, you know, and, so it's you know, it's interesting, but I think, you know, I think the people on this committee understand, you know, what they're asked to do by the NCAA. And we've been, you know, we've been given the ability, we've been given the privilege of working with the NCAA on this championship committee. I think we all take that to heart and try to really put aside your allegiances for that matter for that time. And, you know, and it's not easy to do, but I think, you know, we've been asked to do that, and we'll definitely do that when that time comes.
I guess, Coach, I'll kind of wrap up then, you know, with, so can you kind of paint me a picture of how Selection Sunday paints out? I mean, it doesn't necessarily sound like you guys all meet in a conference room somewhere and hash it out. It sounds more like, you know, conference calls and stuff like that. I mean, it sounds like this could be kind of an interesting setup of, you know, having to constantly jump on and off the phone and that kind of idea. I imagine you're sitting there and waiting to get in results of AQ tournaments and the like, you know, and maybe even what's the tenor of the conversation? I mean, is everybody very measured? And since you've all kind of been tracking this stuff for a couple of weeks, it's fairly, you know, civil and nuanced, or are there, you know, some great arguments at time to time? I mean, how does Selection Sunday play out generally?
Well, usually what we do is we'll have we'll have a RAC call earlier in that week, and that's a big one. You know, that would be next week, and that's a big one because that kind of, there's a lot of games that are going to be played. You know, these next, you know, there's big games played yesterday. You know, there'll be more games played this weekend, and So that's kind of one of the last, rack calls that we'll have a pretty good understanding of everything. And then basically what we end up doing, is on Saturday, at some point on Saturday, after a majority of the games are played on Saturday, we'll get together on a phone call and kind of say, okay, this is, this team won, this team lost. There's going to be some AQs that will be wrapped up that Saturday. And we just start, plugging in the AQs, those 19 AQs. And then, hopefully by then, I think most of the Pool Bs would have played their final games, I think. And we should be able to maybe even, do the Pool Bs by Saturday evening or at least on Sunday. And then we get together on Sunday, and there's still some conference championship games being played on that Sunday. So you kind of have, part of the bracket or part of the 2019 teams will definitely be open. But I think, what's nice about starting this a couple weeks ago is you really do have a sense of, of a consistency sense of what we've been talking about, what we've been doing, and really kind of play that out. And so you get to that Saturday and Sunday, you're hoping, that you're not throwing any new ring, the time that I've been on, we're not getting on that call Saturday and being like, and throwing a curveball, if we have to, we'll have to deal with it. But we've been fortunate enough that you do your due diligence, you do your homework, you kind of get that weekend, you can start just kind of placing teams where you think they're going to be fit. And, and that's the goal. I think it's been great. We've had, we've had some people, that have helped us out, getting on the call because certain people could not be on it based on the fact that their teams are involved. Most people have been great helps, like Dave Campbell. I think last year Middlebury was on the call, and he was awesome, for our committee. And I think it's very civil. I think you have a job to do, and you're trying to work yourself through it. And then you wake up Monday and you look at the bracket again. You're like, okay, I think we did the best job we possibly could, And now let's get the fun part going. Let's get the game going,
And I guess, Coach, you said this is your last year. So, are you going to be happy next year to maybe have this part of your, your responsibilities or the stress or what have you of it gone? And you'll just be sitting around like everybody else on Selection Sunday waiting to see where your team ends up? Or will maybe part of you kind of miss being a part of this whole committee process and building the overall tournament field?
Well, I think you sign up for this because you care about the sport, you care about, you enjoy this part of it. I'm also an assistant athletic director here at Lynchburg. And I know we've hosted women's soccer tournaments here and field hockey tournaments here. And it's exciting. I think you see it through the eyes of the student athlete, it's a fun part of it. So it's definitely a part of it you'll be missed. I don't think you'll miss all the phone calls and all the, the kind of the big work stuff that goes along with it. But at the end of the day, you kind of hope your team's still, maybe involved in a playing capacity, which would be nice. But I think if anything, you gain an appreciation. You gain an appreciation really for what goes into this. What goes into determining the championship field and how it gets selected, because there is a lot of myths and just stuff that people say out there that just like that's not true. And I think our committee has really tried to be as transparent as we possibly can to relay this information out to people so they see it and they understand it. And at the end of the day, when we select the selection show, and people can kind of say, okay, I could see where they're going with that, I'll root for the next group, do the best job they possibly can. I think there's going to be great people coming on board, and it's just a fun environment, and it's kind of neat being at the championship weekend as well and seeing all the teams practice and seeing them go through the motions and playing lacrosse and just being there, being on the field level for a Division II and III and Division I championship is pretty unique. Not everyone gets a chance to do that. So I've been very grateful for the opportunity that I've been given.
Well, Coach, thank you very much for really diving into this and explaining to me the tournament field. Best of luck to Lynchburg in getting through the ODAC and hopefully getting yourself into the field. And beyond that, best of luck trying to, sort everything out come selection weekend here. And now I feel like I got some good background, so I guess the next step will be taking a crack at a little D3 bracketology. But
there will be, and Zach, one other thing I want to, as I told you, I'd find this out, there will be three teams that will not play that first Wednesday. So whoever they are, they will not be playing. There's only going to be three teams that essentially get a bye from the first round to the second round. So that helps you with the bracket.
And I gather that'll be like three highest seeds, more or less. I mean, is it two, one region, one try the other?
We'll try to work that as best we can.
Okay. All right. Well, Coach, thank you very much for giving me all this great background here. And I said, best of luck trying to figure this all out.
Thank you very much for setting it up. I appreciate it.
Take care. Well, that gives us a lay of the land in terms of tournament structure, bid breakdown, and selection criteria. In part two now, we'll move on to some D3 bracketology.